Well, I really enjoyed The Red President. I read it in two sittings, the second sitting last night, finished at about 8. I had to take it away from my wife, who is a big fan of thrillers and mysteries. You can see she gets the Murder, Inc.
Right.
And that's where she is. She said, don't lose my place. So I really enjoyed it. It's a nice change of pace to read something like that as well. There are some, I think in all thrillers, though, there are some implausibilities. But I think you sort of suspend your belief and just get caught up in the action.
It's exactly the opposite of what I did for most of my life. I wrote serious nonfiction, three books. I edited a book magazine. I was a book publisher. I taught college. And there's no disbelief. Everything has to be concrete and hard. And I said to myself just recently, wouldn't it be fun? I read Ken Follett, and I read Tom Clancy, and Nelson DeMille, and Ludlum. And I said, wouldn't it be fun to write one? And I found, actually, there was quite a bit of fun. Quite a bit. It's a total departure from, not from reality, because I tried to build as much reality as I could in, but there are leaps you have to make. I have Congress sometimes doing things in hours in my book that will take weeks or months in reality.
The naming of the vice president.
That's right, exactly, yeah.
Be a matter of spirited debate for months, probably.
I think I did it in about 6 hours. It was necessary for the time frame of the action of the thriller towards the end. And the in suspending disbelief, of course, you need an excuse, and the excuse was the national security. The nation was at stake, and therefore Congress had to name this new vice president to possibly replace the bad red president who was down at Camp David, possibly undoing the country.
Well, he wasn't really so bad.
No, he wasn't.
Naive.
He was naive, yes. He wasn't an evil man. He was a rich man, handsome, charismatic, telegenic, which, of course, is why he got the popularity. He got his popularity because he was so handsome and telegenic and wealthy and didn't even wear a tie in the White House, wore a sport jacket and shirt and chino slacks and loafers. And when he spoke at college, the girls kissed him. And he needed purpose. And, of course, he was converted, as you know, by his very dedicated Marxist-Leninist administrative assistant who had been a poor dirt farmer as a boy in Alabama. But the Red President tries to find purpose and finds in Marxism and finds that even the Russians treat even he poorly, which of course is he didn't expect that. He expected he would be an equal partner of the Soviet, and he finds the Soviet Union tends to kick a lot of people around, including even the Red President.
Well, the book comes in two parts, the events leading up to the election of the president and then what happens after he is in the Oval Office. I like the second half best because the pace kept building as that imminent date, what was it called, Stand Down
was the plot where the Red President cooperates with the Soviet, takes down our Star Wars, goes through a even larger disarmament, and the Russians now, without telling him, because they don't trust the Red President, he's too American. He has too many native roots. They trust his administrative system. They don't trust him. They don't tell him this. And they're preparing not for a partnership, but for the takeover of America through not a nuclear war, but really a nuclear blackmail. It's called Stand Down, which is almost played out on a computer. The Russians say, now, if we do this and you do this and you don't have this, we're going to be able to conquer you. And, of course, I can't give away the real ending, but the penultimate point is when the Red President falls down on his knees in Camp David and says, my God, what have I done? How could I have believed these people?
Well, The Red President is really a timely book because there seems to be, I don't know if I want to characterize it as a degree of paranoia, but at least concern about a Russian takeover. I think that's going to manifest itself with this ABC miniseries called America.
Right. So, now, of course, they not only suspend disbelief, they suspend disbelief exponentially. They have, a United Nations takeover. I have a background in politics. I ran the Stevenson primary out in Long Island as a young boy and young man, and I was a delegate to the National Convention. I was John Kennedy's floor manager in New York State for VP. And so I said, when I write a thriller, why not write about something I know, which is politics? I think that helps to build a tapestry of reality, because I was on the floor of the convention as my Red President is. And I forgot your question.
About America being paranoid.
The paranoia on both sides is inevitable. And the reason it's inevitable is because we're faced, it's as if all of history became condensed into these few years. We had French empires and Roman empires, Greek empires, British empires, and finally we've come down really to two nations swaying half the globe. Alexis de Tocqueville in 1835, and I put it in the dedication of the book, said that these two nations, as yet unknown, are destined to sway each of them half the globe. And we've come to that point. So the paranoia is naturally larger than it's ever been because these two giants are facing each other with two different systems, each convinced that their system is superior. So the book becomes really a metaphor for this conflict, and I think in a way for good and evil, from my point of view, because we're better than they are in a moral sense and in a future sense. So I try to harken back to the old days of the novel when good and evil were really the main threads of the drama, whether it was Dickens or Emile Zola. I think our novelists had always used that. We've lost some of that. I tried to bring a little of it back here.
Well, that's consistent with writing thrillers, isn't it? It's always evil against good.
Right. Some thrillers, of course, tend to equate the KGB and the CIA both as being professional, equal professionals doing their job. I do that, too. I show that the CIA has its ugly manifestations, and I even have an occasional KGB person with his softer soul, for example, the illegal, who grew up in Manhattan, the son of the Polish consulate, now has come back to America, transformed himself into an American a script writer for documentary films, changes his name to Tom Ward, and at the end, of course, he helped save America through a love affair. You also have to have a little love in there. In a thriller.
Did you ever live in Washington?
No, but I covered Washington as a young man. I used to write for Collier's, that Evening Post, True Magazine, etc. And then I did a syndicated column for several years, syndicated in dailies throughout the country that was mostly Washington covered. So I was on the shuttle an awful lot. So I know the city intimately.
Why did you get out of politics after this promising start? As you know?
Yes, I had I was publicity chairman for the Nassau County. Some people think I did more than anybody to help build that party in Nassau County. And I stayed with it until after JFK got in, and then I moved to Manhattan. And I found politics in Manhattan rather, quote, professional. That is, the people down there were lawyers and people who were making politics their life. With me, I was a writer, and it was an avocation. And out in Long Island, it was grassroots. And in New York, you missed the grassroots aspect of politics. So I tried it and moved away from it. And I became a spectator. And now I'm back into politics vicariously with a political thriller.
I think this is probably more fun than the real stuff.
Perhaps.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at City College, and then I did graduate work in literature at Columbia. And I think it was the graduate work at Columbia that swayed me from being a fiction writer, because spending 3 years studying the greats, I think you get a bit awed. And the only fiction writing I ever did was short story writing at City College with Professor Goodman. He was a rather famous short story writer. And the only C I got at college was in his class. So I said, Professor Goodman, does that mean I'm a bad writer? He said, no. He said, I gave Paddy Chayefsky a D, and I gave Alfred Kazin an F. I don't know if that's apocryphal, but that's what he told me. So he said, don't feel bad. Maybe you have a future. So perhaps he had a reverse grading procedure.
Well, Kazin did tell me at one point that he was a very bad student, and he only studied what he wanted to study. But I'm appalled that he did so poorly in English class. That's terrible.
But I don't think it's the fact that he did poorly, because my short stories, he used to give me A's and B's. I think the C was a kind of reverse reward. And he was a strange man. When he died, Paddy Chayefsky went to his funeral, and the Times covered it in the second section. And they asked Chayefsky, you must have loved this man. He said, my God, no, he was impossibly bad.
Well, when I was a child, I was a broadcast journalism major in college, but I also minored in English with an emphasis in creative writing. And about 2 years ago, I went back to the university and had dinner with my old creative writing professor, 1955. He didn't remember me, of course, but I remember the stories that I used to inflict on him. And I don't, no wonder he has just blotted me out of his mind. He knew I passed through, but he couldn't remember. But he had a very nice, gentle way. I don't know if it was the case with Professor Goodman, but my professor, Professor Summers, had a very nice way. If he didn't like something in your story, he would write, I can't hear.
Oh, that's good.
If he liked something, he would write, this pleases me.
That's right. No, Goodman was quite the opposite. He was about 5'1", and he got up on a chair sometimes and delivered tirades. And I tended to be late for class, and he used to call me the late Mr. Gross. He was quite the opposite. As a matter of fact, when I got the C, I sent him a letter explaining that it was an impossible grade for the work I did, and he called me down to his office. He said, "Gross, I'll tell you something." He said, "It was a great letter." He said, "Forget short stories. Write letters for a living."
What a character.
Yeah, he was quite a character.
Well, what did you do when you got out of college?
When I got out of college, I worked on weekly newspapers, and then I was very fortunate in the middle 50s. It was the golden age of magazines, and I started as a very young man in my early 20s writing for the major magazines, making the equivalent of a fortune today. I remember I did a two-part article for the Saturday Evening Post when I was maybe 26 years old. I spent 3 weeks at it, and I got $10,000, and my house only cost me $12,000. And it was a distorted sense of compensation because television was just brand new, and the magazines were the major media, and they were paying a lot of money. So I really enjoyed magazines. Then I naturally drifted into book writing, and I did 3 books for Random House. The Brainwatchers on Psychological Testing, The Doctor as a Critique of American Medicine, and The Psychological Society, a Critique of Freud. And then I started a magazine called Book Digest.
You actually started that?
Yes, I was the founder. It was created in the luncheonette on Madison Avenue in my head, and with friends we raised the money, and I was the founder and editor-in-chief, and we ran it for about 8 years, quite successfully.
Oh, I remember that. It's no longer around.
No, we sold it to a major corporation, and I sort of drifted away. I'm not the major corporation type.
And
they closed it about a year later.
It folded about a year or two later. I don't recall seeing it.
They changed the format. As soon as I left, they changed. Corporations tend to buy things and change them. They changed everything. It lost its, they even changed the size. It was a small digest-sized thing.
Oh, I remember it. I used to read it on a regular basis. And I think you had a variety of different types of books.
Everything, all political points of view. It was kaleidoscopic, eclectic, and I tried not to take my points of view and push them into the selection of books, so that I had a broad spectrum appealing to everyone. My job was to just take what the author said and do it as accurately as possible. We had about 12 Nobel Prize winners over the 8 years. We had the Pulitzer Prize winners, the best writers, and after the material was cut, it was resubmitted to the writer before we would print it for his approval. And we never failed to get approval. They all liked it.
Well, you took the Reader's Digest idea and advanced it, didn't you?
I think so. And also, we never changed a word. You see, some people condense things. We didn't change a word. It was all done by cutting a paragraph here, a page here, a chapter here, and put together into a new package, which gave the feeling of the book. And then the author looked at it again. And so I developed a very peculiar art of cutting books. When I was on an airplane once, I was reading The Greening of America, and with a pencil I was crossing out paragraphs. And the lady over my shoulder said, "My God, young man, what are you doing to that book?" Couldn't understand why I was crossing out paragraphs.
Well, when I was a kid, growing up in a middle western, conventional type family, that's really all we had in the household. We had the Saturday Evening Post and Reader's Digest, and the Reader's Digest book condensations.
Yes, yes.
And the Reader's Digest does something strange with its condensations.
They actually rewrite, don't they?
No.
No?
They don't actually they do excise certain words.
Yeah.
They make sure that there's no sex and that there is no questionable language in their books. And if any book is too gloomy, for example,
they'll make it lighter.
No, they'll just won't use it.
Oh, won't use it.
Sophie's Choice has a suicide pact.
Yes.
And it's a brilliant novel, but they looked at it and said, "Well, that's not for us. It'll disturb our readers."
Right, so they didn't run it.
But you didn't take a philosophical approach like that, did you?
No, no, not at all. No, all it was. We chose the books because we thought they were good books, and then they were just cut to size. Generally, I would read the book through, take out 4 or 5 pertinent chapters from 15 or 20 chapters, and then starting cutting the 4 chapters. So it became a new package, which was exactly the thrust of the book. Sometimes you'd find a chapter or two that sufficed, perhaps a survey chapter in a nonfiction book where the author had really told what he wanted to tell, and then I could just take the chapter and use that. It varied. In writing thrillers, I found at first that I was writing in a very strong literary sense, which would be my tendency because of my academic background. And then I found that when I finished it, I wasn't entertained enough. So I went back and kept the same philosophical and intellectual thrust, but added the sense of theater and drama. Robert Ludlum once told me, when I Book Digest, I interviewed Ludlum, he said he had been an actor and a director and a producer in the theater. He said, so when I write, he said, I'm writing stage. So I sort of borrowed that idea. Maybe I borrowed movie sense more than theater sense, cinematography, so that I have 105 chapters in the book, which is sort of 105 scenes, and each of them leading quickly into the other, moving back and forth, just as if I were editing film.
Yes, I noticed the chapters are very short, which is nice, because that really moves
it forward.
The action fast, in the way a movie fast cuts. Right.
And I also had to do that because I have so many characters in the book that I had to keep interposing the one to the other. I had seven Democratic candidates, ranging from extreme conservative hawks all the way to Brooke Somerville, a professor of Harvard who was a left-winger. Now, my red president, if you remember, was not exactly a left-winger. He was a charismatic liberal, opposing as a charismatic liberal. If I were the head of the KGB American section, Colonel Lev Orlov in my book, I wouldn't pick a left-winger to be my red spy to get into the White House as part of Oval Red. I would pick somebody more acceptable, which is what they do. That is, my anti-hero, my protagonist, the Red President, is acceptable under general patriotic terms to most of the Americans, although somewhat left of center. And I think that's much more clever than saying, well, here I'm a left-winger, elect me president, because it's not about to happen in America. America is basically a country in the middle, one party a little left of center, and the other party a little right of center, and much of it right in the middle. So I portray the KGB as what they are, rather clever. There are parallels in real life to the KGB skill and the American naivete. For example, in Washington, and I mention it in my book, there's the Soviet embassy, the new Soviet embassy, and it's on Wisconsin Avenue. It's 9 acres. They're moving everything into it, and it's the highest point of land in Washington, D.C., Mount Alto, it's called. It has a clear line of electronic sight to the Capitol, to the House, to the Senate, to the White House, to the CIA, Defense Department, State Department, and they can listen in on any telephone in Washington except those that are what they call secure telephones, of which we don't have that many. And so the Russians, in choosing their embassy site, and America in giving them the embassy site, showed a cleverness. And throughout the book, the KGB is quite clever. The only thing that foils them in the end is the kind of native patriotism, even of my red president.
Back to Book Digest for just a moment. When did you form Book Digest?
1974. And I ran it until 1981, or perhaps early 82.
And then you say you sold it because...
Well, we sold it, I think. I wasn't in financial control at the time. I think it was sold basically for monetary reasons and also probably because an opportunity to expand. Mm-hmm. And then I stayed there about a year. And
as the
editor-in-chief, and decided to become a book publisher. And so I left. My contract expired, neither I would renew it or not renew it. And I left, and I became a book publisher of a small company called Empire Books. And I did that for about a year and a half. And published serious nonfiction, all well-received. But the workload of a small book publishing company suspends disbelief. It's absolutely incredible. It's an around-the-clock operation.
How big a staff did you have?
I had three other people besides me, four people. And couldn't have really afforded big staff, couldn't afford a big capitalization, so I was trying to operate. Now, years ago, it would have worked nicely. Go back 30 years, small companies could manage, you could make some money on each book without each book being heavily promoted, but not today, so that I put an awful amount of time and attention into promotion, editing, graphics, so that each book was quite good, quite well-received, but it was a draining activity. So I decided I'd go back to writing, and I said, well, write another serious nonfiction book or write a piece of fiction. In writing a piece of fiction, I could either do a literary work or a thriller. And I decided a thriller would be more fun.
Now, when did you disband Empire Books?
I only did it for about 2 years, about 1984.
Is it still in existence?
No, completely closed. I do some co-publishing, The co-publishing actually fits my skills better. In the co-publishing, I do all the editorial work, and the co-publisher does the publishing. So, for example, right now I'm co-publishing two books. My Story, the Autobiography of President Duarte of El Salvador, a G.P. Putnam book. And another G.P. Putnam book, My 10,000 Hours on Television, by Hugh Downs, his memoir. And I also did The Kennedys by Collier and Horowitz, the number one bestseller. I did that with Summit Books. So I may do some more co-publishing, because in co-publishing, it's creative. You get the idea, you get the writers, and you edit the book.
It's called book packaging,
isn't it? Book packaging, I suppose. But in packaging, I think it leaves out the element that I do, which is the editing. I spent a lot of time editing the Duarte book. Many book packages sort of just do the business end of it. I do the whole thing.
That way you give the Putnam or whoever
a finished
whole package there.
Right, right. I did a finished manuscript on Duarte, and I did, and I found the writer, worked with him, edited the same thing on Hugh Downs. And, but I must tell you that I am hooked on fiction.
Now,
absolutely hooked on it. All my life, I read a great deal of fiction and studied it in graduate school, but now I'm hooked on writing it. I'm in the middle of my second book.
Another thriller?
Another thriller. Also political, totally different. But I must say that I'm probably addicted to the Oval Office. It's about a president who's quite patriotic, who has an enormous number of problems. And those problems are reflected in the nation's problems. And again, brinksmanship, but final solution.
The thrillers often work, I see two kinds of thrillers. I see, because I read a lot of them, one is the international thriller. This is, The Red President is an international thriller.
Right.
The other is a thriller that usually involves small people who are somehow terrorized or caught up in events that they can't control.
Someone who lives in a small town in Connecticut and is a psychotic killer roaming the streets, perhaps.
Yeah, or kidnapping.
Kidnapping.
Baby, or
right. I would tend towards the larger scale because that's my personality, and I'm pretty good at both politics and international relations. For example, and reporting. For example, I had to take my character Lev Orlov from Teplistan, which is the KGB headquarters, 15 miles outside of Moscow. I had to take him to the Kremlin for a meeting, and I wanted to be sure I was accurate. Well, I spent 2 weeks finding out how he would go from there. When he got to the Red Square, what entrance he would have to go in to the Presidium building, what the Presidium building looked like, and there are no pictures of it, where it is exactly, where the entrance door is, where the meeting would be, and if they looked out the window on the second floor back of the Presidium building, what would they see? And so I did all of this, a lot of tedious work, but it helps me feel that the book is authentic, and I think it helps the reader. And so if I have somebody going down to the White House, I had to take them through Pennsylvania Avenue and the entrance, etc., in detail.
Oh, it has to be plausible. I was reading a book that it was a thriller published by Stein and Day, and I didn't like it at all. And there were several reasons. This was written by an Irishman, but it was set mostly in New York. And he just had everything wrong. I mean, he had, I think he had Columbia University in Harlem. And he had streets wrong and places wrong.
Yeah.
And it, as I read it, being now an adopted New Yorker, this just what didn't happen.
You can't do that.
It has to be right.
Because when I finished the book, I have a friend who was a high executive in the CIA, retired, an administrator, but at an important level. And I sent him the book and to check everything out. And he sent me back a letter saying almost everything is exact. And he gave me a few little things that weren't exact regarding the CIA, et cetera, and I fixed them. And I had one big problem. I have my CIA man who has fled Langley because he has this file, and because he has this file, the KGB kills his wife, and he's now going to take revenge on the Red President on the floor of the convention. And he's got to get into the convention with a gun through a metal detector. So I have to find how he does that. So I call my CIA friend. He says, a Glock, of course. I said, what is a Glock? Well, a Glock is a real gun that costs $1,500, and it's all ceramic. So he buys a Glock. And
plastic gun.
Actually, ceramic. It's, and he goes through the thing. Then when I finished it, I also gave it to a friend of mine who's a Washington bureau of a big newspaper, and he went through. He didn't find much with the geography. I made sure that when the House was meeting, the Judiciary Committee was in the right room. And the authenticity helps me. I don't know if it helps the reader. It helps me feel that I'm creating a real scenario.
Well, you have to know these things because that makes you feel positive about what you're doing.
That's right.
And if you don't, there's always this question mark.
Right.
This elusive question that I may have been writing it wrong.
Right, and I had
you
been...
don't have confidence.
Right, and having been a delegate to the convention, I had experience on the floor. As a matter of fact, I handled JFK's VP nomination in New York State in 56, and I ran around like a madman in the last minutes, and I switched 11 Kefauver votes to Jack Kennedy. Fortunately, he lost the VP nomination because he possibly wouldn't have gotten... And on the way home, by coincidence, I flew home on the plane. My wife, myself, John Kennedy, and his wife. It was a coach plane from Chicago, where the convention was, through Pittsburgh to New York. And we talked on the plane, and I said, Senator Kennedy, I said, you're very lucky that we lost. And he said, why? I said, because next time we come back and nominate you for the presidency, had you been a losing VP candidate, he might not be as attractive. And he was feeling badly. That cheered him up. And it worked. John Kennedy was an amazing man. Amazing man.
You also have the first political convention in the new Javits Convention Center.
That's right. They would like that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, New Yorkers love that.
They would love that. But I think, are they losing out on that? I don't know.
Well, they haven't lost completely. The Democrats haven't decided where they're going to go yet.
So perhaps my book will... Now, of course, I don't say this is 1988. The Red President could be 1992. As a matter of fact, probably more 1992 than 88, because the Red President's first act when he gets in... excuse me. Red President's first act when he gets in is to take down the first deployed Star Wars unit. So I would imagine that's more likely early 90s.
I'm glad you didn't have a date, because when you have a date, then you think about... If you have, especially if it's a date that is as close as this,
right.
Then you begin to think, well, that can't be the majority leader, and
right, exactly,
can't be a senator from such and such, and these names don't jive. I'd rather just keep it kind of mythical,
right?
And people can take their own date in.
One of my biggest jobs was, who's the hero of the book? And I sat down and I thought that through, because I have a lot of characters, and I said, John Davidson's the hero. John Davidson is 68 years old.
Was he patterned after Alan Dulles?
No. I patterned him after no one, but I must tell you that since the book has come out, a half a dozen people have told me it's James Jesus Angleton. Now, James Jesus Angleton is alive and well. I think he lives in Virginia. He was the chief of counterintelligence of the CIA. And my character is 68 years old, chief of counterintelligence of the CIA, retired, forced out in a kind of internecine inner CIA war, and he was dismissed. With a little shadow over his head, but in my book he's very patriotic, and he operates outside of the CIA, because when the Red President gets in, he naturally takes over the CIA. So my man organizes a group of patriots in the Congress, in the CIA, old friends, and together they work to try to reestablish some power. And I make him a strategist, a thinker. He doesn't move. He's always in his chair at the Cosmos Club. That's at 21st Massachusetts. It was the former home found out of Sumner Wells. Now it's the Cosmos Club, which is in Washington, they say, the home for the bright Washingtonians, while the Metropolitan Club is the home for the rich Washingtonians. Anyway, he sits in a chair there, a dark brown wing chair in the dark second-floor library, and people come to him, journalists, intellectuals, and he talks about what he knows unclassified about the Cold War. So he's pure chess master. And then we have soldiers in the CIA who help him. And another hero is a liberal newsman, Doug McDowell. And people
well, I didn't understand about that when he was kidnapped first by the CIA and then turned over to the KGB.
Right.
What were they going to do with him?
Well, the reason that they kidnapped him was this. First, the CIA has now been taken over by the Red President, and Davidson has McDowell go on the air and issue two words which a friend of his in the CIA told him, stand down. They don't know what it means, but stand down is actually the nuclear blackmail plot, and therefore they must get McDowell out of the way. So they have the CIA kidnap him, then the CIA turns him over to the KGB, who take them to a place that actually exists, a point in Chesapeake Bay, 50 miles from Washington, which is the summer residence of the Soviet embassy. It's the former home of the Chrysler heir. And it's a beautiful big house on a point of land jutting out into the bay. They take him there, and the idea is that they're probably going to keep him incommunicado for quite some time, but more important, find out how he knows about stand down. But his very kidnapping triggers a whole series of events, which eventually ends up in the newsroom of the network, where the news director, Milt Samuels, who didn't believe any of this, now gets involved. So we have, most people don't believe there's anything going on. They think, well, the red president is sort of soft in his head and we'll give him a chance. And they don't know any of these machinations. And then little by little it leaks out from Davidson to McDowell to Milt Samuels. Milt Samuels, I had him be an early Brooklyn resident, sort of chubby with red suspenders. And he disbelieves all this nonsense, but little by little he begins to believe. So each person in turn starts to trigger a little more of the knowledge that things are not totally kosher in the Oval Office.
Well, Martin Gross, it's a very entertaining film. It really moves, I think, of the people who purchase a copy of The Red President that will not be disappointed. And I'm prepared to say that on the radio. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.